Well, congratulations for winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
And this is a beautiful book. I'm sorry that I missed you the first time around.
Yeah. Well,
but I had a chance to catch up, and it's one of these books that I say this with a certain amount of difficulty, but I mean it in your case, that it's one of these books that was really hard to put down.
Oh, really? Thank you.
I think I read it in at least two sittings.
Wow.
If I'd been a little more alert that week, I probably would have done it in one. But,
oh, really?
Isn't it strange, though? You know, you spend, I don't know how much time you spent writing this book, probably a couple of years, but you spend all this time writing a book and someone reads it in a day and a half.
I know, it's crazy. It's like cooking dinner and people, you spend all day making it and then people eat it in like 8 seconds, depending on who's over at your house. Some people take longer. But, yeah.
Tell me about the Mambo Kings and how the idea for this novel occurred to you.
Well, what happened is I wanted to write a novel about the musicians. That's the one idea I had, but I didn't know quite how to approach it. That idea started out with a superintendent who happened to have a lot of talent. He'd whistle, he'd walk across a courtyard, he'd sing. Neighbors would hear him. I got the idea. I mean, everything's falling backward in my head right now, but basically I got the idea from an elevator operator in my building who had once been a crooner down in the Dominican Republic. I turned around and I discovered that I had a cousin named Angel who had once been a crooner down in Cuba. Then I had an uncle named Pedro who had once played with Javier Cugat and Desi Arnaz back in the 30s and 40s. And it all started coming together. I realized that this superintendent had once been a singer and a star of the dance halls, and that was my first idea. Then I started looking into the music more, really listening to a lot of the records, old records, 78s and 33s, and slowly the idea of when Mambo Kings play songs of love evolved. And that's really basically it. I wanted to write a book that would acquaint people with the music, not as a musicologist, but as a fan, and also as a fan of the people in that world. So yeah, I hope I accomplished that.
Well, you certainly did accomplish that. You took a risk in some respects. You put real characters in with the fictional ones.
Oh, you mean a gentleman like Desi Arnaz?
Sure. And,
well, I got the idea of Desi Arnaz. I mean, I always liked him. We grew up watching the show. I grew up watching the show. And my father liked it. And my father was from the same province as Desi Arnaz. And I always wondered about who these characters who appeared on that show were, what they were like. So that eventually became another element in the Mambo Kings play songs of love. I like Desi Arnaz. I like the way he looked. I like the way he thought. I like the way he spoke on the show. I mean, it was humorous and zany, but on the other hand, he's had real qualities, I thought. And that's also Lucille Ball has those qualities of being a real person, which is why I think it's such a popular show. But I didn't know how to come up, how to use this idea of a character and really. He didn't appear in the novel until the moment he needed to appear, which is the brothers were playing in a club one night, and he walked in on his own accord. I didn't have to call him up or dig him out or force him into the novel or try to figure out a lot of ways. How can I use Desi Arnaz? And once he heard them, the idea of having them go on his television show playing his cousins came to me. So, but it's a risk, and in that you don't know whether it's a real portrait or if it's true to life or whatever, but I understand that people who've read the book, including, I think, Arnaz's daughter, read it and thought it was a nice portrait of him.
So you had to do some research into Desi as well?
A little bit. I mean, I read his biography, A Life, which
did you go to his house? I know his house has a role at the end of the book.
Oh, Belmont, California. Mm-hmm. Belmont or Belmore, I forget what I call it. But I had a fantasy about his house. I knew that he lived somewhere in that area of California. And so I just sort of fantasized when the nephew, Eugenio, who travels to sum up part of the plot is Desi Arnaz keeps in touch with the family. And Eugenio, who's a nephew of the Mambo King, goes out to visit Desi Arnaz in California. And when I was writing that section, I was sort of in a state of ecstasy because it seemed so real to me. And what would a wealthy Cuban do but move to a place that's sunny and filled with flowers and maybe try to recreate scenes from his past there? So in the novel, Mr. Arnaz's estate or whatever you want to call it, it seems to be set up like parts of Cuba, you know, with stairways and fountains and stuff like that. But by the time I got there, I was sort of in a state of what Nabokov used to call aesthetic bliss or something. You don't know if it's right. You don't know intellectually if it's right, but you feel intuitively that you're doing the right thing, as Spike Lee would say.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be right. I think you have to give an idea, a feeling, an impression.
Mm-hmm. That's
what makes the novel work for people rather than the collection of facts. You can read facts about Desjardins and his biography.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the funny thing, you want to, in a novel, you want to get under people's skins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, you could write a novel, I guess, about anything, construction workers, people who are ticket takers in movies. I mean, that's just a surface. It's just the outer aspect. I'm sorry, I was in California yesterday, so now I'm talking like a guru, but it's about the outer aspect. And really, a novel should be concerned with the inward world of the characters. And in Mambo Kings, I was fortunate to find this language, vivid language, and also energy from the music. But I think I could have written about other kinds of inner lives with other kinds of characters.
I was just interviewing a relatively young British writer. His name is Ian McEwan.
He's great. Cement Garden.
Cement Garden, yes. And his new one is called The Innocent.
Oh, he's a wonderful writer.
And in The Innocent, he describes the tunneling under East Berlin,
mm-hmm.
so that the CIA can tap the Soviet telephone lines,
mm-hmm.
in 1955.
Wow.
And he makes references, a lot of technical references,
mm-hmm.
about phone trunks and Ampex recorders and so forth. And so I asked him about that, and he said, well, most of it I made up. He said, it's not really true. It may give the impression, but it wasn't about,
mm-hmm.
the technology of that era.
Mm-hmm.
It was about people.
The atmosphere.
Yeah, so he just wanted to give a feeling about it without... however, there are some readers who absolutely insist on accuracy within a novel, and everything,
yes.
has to be correct. And in some respects, it does. I mean, it has to be legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a place that doesn't exist necessarily if everything else has a feeling of reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Well, the thing is, you try to find a connection or try to reflect what your emotions are about something by the way you describe them in the novel. So in the Mambo Kings, for example, there's a ballroom called the Park Plaza, which in the novel is sort of like a giant technicolor place with mirrored columns and plush railings and everything you could want, whereas in real life it was a former Jewish catering hall that was very simple, that slowly was rented, you know, began to rent out space to these groups that wanted to go there and have dances, and then it absolutely flourished. And the fact of the place is that it was glamorous because of the music being played there and because of the people and their attitudes about it who, you know, got decked out and went out. But when I wrote it in the novel, I sort of took the idea of that glamour and energy and put it in the prose. And once you start doing that, you start adding brass railings and shoeshine boys and all kinds of things like that that did exist. They did exist, but you sort of put it together as a compilation. I was in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and this chap who played the conga drums for a living said, you know, you never have the congas with the timbales together in your configurations in the book. Why is that? And I said, because I didn't really, I don't know. It seemed to work at the time. And he said, well, you know, you should put different combinations together, or you have a quinto drum and then you have a conga, you know. It was so technical, but he loved the book anyway. He said, well, next time around, maybe you can change these things. And I told him, I said, well, why don't you write me a note where you found, if you found it inaccurate or maybe difficult from a musician's point of view, let me know. But there's so many things that happen that will add to the reality of the world. And for me, it's the emotional reality that should come through. And I hope I did that in different sections. And
you certainly have a nice contrast between the two brothers, Nestor and the Mambo. Well, what was his name then?
Cesar Castillo?
Yeah. It's Caesar?
Cesar.
Cesar,
well,
and that's the real
Cesar,
Spanish pronunciation.
Yeah. You can call him Cesar.
Cesar.
I named him sort of after Cesar Romero.
He certainly had a terrific sexual appetite, didn't he? It must be part of the Latin temperament, huh?
Well, I think it's more me sitting there all by myself a lot by the typewriter. No, I was sort of tired of the way a lot of sex was being, love scenes were being written in novels, sort of as almost like little brief, embarrassed, technical aphids in the bee kind of things. And so when I went for the love scenes in the book, I sort of wanted to do them in a raunchy, word-loving way. Also, affectionate towards women, obviously. That's the way Cesar relates to them. And it takes him years and years to figure out that you can actually have conversations with women, but in the meantime, he has a lot of fun. But I wanted to do something that would sound sort of like raunchy blues in the context of the book, or if there's an orchestra playing, you have like a line coming in. So really, that serves that, the love scenes in the book, the erotic content, serves that function, but also it's there to balance the pain and the seriousness that one encounters from time to time.
You say quite a bit about the Cuban immigrant experience as well, too. Are you a first generation?
Yeah, my parents came up from Oriente province in 1943, and that's a whole other story, but I was raised in New York City.
And you were born here?
Yeah, I was born in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Log cabin up on the 100th.
Log cabin, I know that place. A lot of people were born in that log
cabin. St. Luke's log cabin. But, you know, I grew up around basically working class people. We didn't know anyone on welfare. We didn't know any, you know, thieves. We didn't know any drug addicts, although there were drug addicts in the neighborhood. I mean, it was just basically old, I guess, New York, which is that you weren't rich, but you made a living, and you had the things that you wanted to do. We didn't go to Paris. We went to Coney Island. We didn't go away to summer camp. We went on the subway down to Staten Island, took the ferry, took a bus to the swimming pool, paid our quarter, went swimming for a couple of hours, and came back. But it wasn't... it was a nice environment in many ways, and in some ways it was unpleasant, but we grew up, in a way the book I hope reflects this, it's just seeing both sides of the coin, the Cuban immigrant experience, I guess if you want to call it that, the lives of people who are working, and not trying to do anyone harm, just trying to live their lives quietly and to raise their families, and on the other side of that is this fabulous creation of mass American culture. So. Well, I grew up in a household of immigrants. I was also aware of movies, Rock Hudson, Godzilla, and television. And I think all these factors, and I think an affection for that whole time comes into the book. I mean, I said I have a scene in there where I talk about Fred McMurray advertising types walking down Madison Avenue. And I worked on 40th Street at one time for 8 years. And I remember walking down the street and saying, this is just sort of like one of those old movies from the 1950s. So you find yourself thinking about Fred McMurray, whether you want to or not, walking down the street. And I bring this into the book, and that's why I think it sort of has this thing to do with that whole world, or the way they touched each other and worked.
Is Spanish your second language?
I was raised in a household that was my first language, but as I got older, I was raised to my parents encouraged me to speak English. So we had this sort of life in the household where they'd speak to me in Spanish and I'd speak to them in English. And you know, I'd run into my aunt. If she only spoke Spanish, I would speak Spanish with her. But it's for their generation, they were having not really been educated in English themselves, they were sort of thrilled to watch their kids learn this new language from this new world of which they were now a part. So my mother, after many, many years of reading, has finally become very fluent in reading English books. But when I was a kid, it was like we were both learning how to read together. It's a different experience.
How does a kid with two languages like that keep them apart?
It's hard. You end up forgetting words. I mean, I remember being in my early 20s and not knowing what apocryphal meant. And then later, when I became a master of apocryphal stories, you just don't have access to the information. And when I was a kid, a lot of the information was in Spanish. And then you go out into the world and you realize you need English as a tool, and all this other kinds of information comes at you in terms of vocabulary and in terms of books and stuff like that. What happens, it sort of pushes the other to the side. And now as I'm getting older, I wish to bring back the original, the Spanish, much more into my life. So on the plane coming over from Los Angeles, an endless trip on a famous airline whose name I won't mention, I was reading a series of interviews in Spanish with Garcia Marquez. And, you know, you try to do it, but it's something that when I was a kid, for example, the books we had in the house were English, not Spanish. So it's a, you know, it has a lot to do with education, the way you're brought along in the world, I think.
I would think a youngster like yourself, would have trouble knowing which is the Spanish and which is the English at certain times.
You mean in terms of hearing it or thinking it? Or
Yeah, when you are exposed to two different languages, mm-hmm. in effect, in the same household, how do you know which is the English and which is the Spanish? And how do you know when not to mix them up?
That's interesting. Well, again, I say in my experience, you know, my parents both spoke Spanish in the household, but it was okay for me to say, you know, okay, I'm going out now, I'll do that for you. On the other hand, I have a good friend of mine named Victor who came up from Cuba in 61, and he didn't know any English at all, and so he became my best pal for about 2 or 3 years, and we, you know, I basically taught him how to speak English. His first words were yo-yo, or jojo, the way he used to say it, and there was no confusion, but I felt more as if though I was bringing him into the dominant culture, because in New York at that time, I mean, it's someone once said to me, oh, you know, in old New York, people weren't interested it was sort of like a sign of prestige, at least with my father's generation in the 40s and early 50s, to learn English and speak it. So when you're saying confusion about growing up, I didn't know quite what the proper thing to do, what it involved, but when you get out into the world, I mean, basically, you have to get the information that, I sound like a management consultant, don't I? We had no clue as to the way the world worked. We had no lawyers, we had no doctors in the neighborhood. We just, you know, you went off to school. I mean, I went to City College, which was a good school, but there was no, I didn't go through a list of 10 colleges, you know, application and all this kind of stuff. To me, getting ahead in the world has a lot to do with access to information. And when you're talking about the complex subject of which languages should one speak or would be best, you get to a point where you realize that people do what they do, they have to do to survive, and hopefully in the process maintain and keep the old stuff. You know, take in the new and keep the good that's old. Isn't there a poem like that or something? But it's a complex thing. I mean, for my own part, I wish my parents had been a little more adamant about maintaining a Spanish-oriented education, that is, bringing books into the house and stuff like that. But, you know, it's all
so
there.
So that you don't drift too far away from the culture.
Right, right.
I was down at the courthouse last year to mm-hmm. try to escape jury duty. And,
oh, man, how did you do it?
I pleaded infirmity. And there was a young man and his mother ahead of me, mm-hmm. and he told the clerk, he said, my mother can't serve on a jury, she does not speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And the clerk said, well, how long has she been in this country? Mm-hmm. And he said, 25 years.
Oh, really? That's funny. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's true. You can go to portions of New York and you hear Spanish. Mm-hmm. And you have this feeling that no English is ever spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a self-contained community, can't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah, I think so. It's you know, mentioning the story about the jury duty, I saw an aunt of mine in California yesterday, and she's been in the United States for 40 years. And, you know, someone in the family says she doesn't speak or understand English except when she wants to. So it's that kind of thing. Yeah, there are communities in New York, in my neighborhood where I live, for example, there are whole sections on Amsterdam Avenue up around 106th, 107th, 108th Street that's predominantly, I would say, Puerto Rican and Dominican. And that's, you know, it's like stepping into little Europe, so to speak. It's funny, I had lived in Europe for a few years, and the images you grow up with about, neighborhoods, like Latin neighborhoods, when I came back, I just went into these little places, and they weren't so different from what one might see in a trattoria in Rome. I mean, the families there with their kids, the music. And yet it seems like New Yorkers have this attitude, or people in America sometimes have an attitude as if though that there was an exotic evil or exotic strangeness in their midst, when it's really very European. I mean, that's what, it's Spanish, you know, the root is Spanish, but it's very a European old world way of life. So it's nice to walk down the street and hear little kids playing, or see little kids playing and see the guy sitting out on the sidewalk or whatever. And it's sort of the kind of thing you would see in Rome, except in Rome they'd be in a little park playing bocce ball, or you'd see it in Spain, people out in cafes. So I think that those pockets of culture really enrich in what we have here in America.
You went to CCNY. Were you an English major?
Well, I sort of like studied Asian history for some reason. I guess I would get a job with the Peace Corps or something. But yeah, I ended up getting an English and eventually did some stuff with playwriting and met the writer Donald Barthelme, who was quite an excellent friend and a wonderful writer and a nice editor. And I learned a lot from him, I think. The value of a good sentence.
What were your intentions after you graduated?
I don't know. I didn't. If you had told me in 1976 that I would, 14 years later, I would have a Pulitzer Prize, I would have said you were stark raving mad. But I just expected to work and try to write novels and see what happened. I mean, I had no... it was 8 years. I worked 8 years at a job before I finally left.
What was that job?
That was TDI Winston Network, which is does all the ads you see on the buses and subways and a lot of that stuff. Clocks. I used to take care of all the clocks. The ones that, you know, maybe 5 and says 4:30. We used to get the guy down there to change the time. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Subway clocks. It was a very. It was interesting. I mean, I liked it. Even that experience affected the Marlboro Kings. I mean, I have girls in a ballroom dressing room. Talking about guys. I mean, some of that stuff I actually was on the spot with the ladies from my office, secretaries. You go out on a Wednesday night and it's all downhill for the rest of the week. And you say, let's go have a drink around the corner at 7 o'clock. And you turn around, it's 2 in the morning and they're telling you your life story. And I know what it feels like to get up at 7:30 and go back to the office and you go, I can't believe it. Yeah, you end up having a giant blackbird in your head, which what Caesar goes through now and then. But they still go to work. They have a strong ethic, a work ethic, and it's you know, a lot of things in my life went in there, and part of it has to do with this job I had.
A lot of things in your life. Edward Abbey told me once. Somebody asked him, "How long does it take to write a novel?" Mm-hmm. And Abbey said, "A lifetime."
Yeah, yeah, it takes. I'm looking forward to being an old person one day and looking, you know, I always think of great old writers like Robert Graves and Jorge Luis Borges and these writers. It must be, I mean, it's one thing that you can get better at as you get older. It's not like being a pitcher for a baseball team or something like that. I mean, as I think the mind flourishes over the years and the accumulation of detail and experiences and emotions is what I hope will lead to, you know, wiser worldly novels.
And yeah, and another thing, too, Sue Miller, I did an interview with her a while back, and she was saying that there's no...
An excellent writer.
Yeah.
Yes.
She says there's no such thing as the primitive school of writing. You know, very few Grandma Moses of writing. It takes a certain degree of skill that you have to build on year after year. I guess there are untrained, undisciplined writers, like Kerouac and James Jones. I mean, they were... rather undisciplined, but it takes study and thought to be able to do it, I think.
Well, I think you have to go to, you know, starting a new novel is like going back to kindergarten as far as I'm concerned, because people assume that if you've won a Pulitzer Prize that you sort of got your PhD and stamp of approval, and that, of course, when you sit down again, it all comes flowing out impeccably sculptured sentences. But for me, the process has to do with figuring out what the initial feelings are, what kind of events in your character's lives are you going to be talking about. What in the Mambo Kings, I use a lot of music as sort of as an emotional device, I guess. And in the new book that I'm working on, I'm not quite sure what it is. It all takes time to figure out what the elements are in the book and how do you want to put them together and what emotions you're going to be talking about. But again, I'm back at kindergarten. I just have to figure out what's going on. And you have to figure out how it relates to your craft and how you can improve your craft while writing a book. And it's all back to school for me, gang.
Well, The Mambo Kings is not your first book. You published, what was it?
Our House in the Last World.
Yeah, tell me about that one.
Well, Our House in the Last World is essentially, we just sold it to Spain. It's coming out. In Tulane, I mean, it's great for me because it's a book about basically my parents' experience coming to this country, and the most autobiographical of anything I've ever written. And although there's a lot of improvisation and filling in the blanks, but it's the fact that it's a book about Cubans coming to New York and their struggles with the language and so forth. Put that up against the fact that it's being published in Spain. in Spanish and in Catalan language. I mean, it's sort of like a beautiful circle, and I can't wait to give my mother these books in the language, because my mother's family going way back was from Barcelona. So it's really just about the working class neighborhood and the family struggles, some personal difficulties, I guess, but in a way it's about how people strive. I mean, I'm starting to get all the advertising jargon down, but what I mean is I meant it as a heartfelt and hopefully objective, soulful answer to a lot of questions I had about my parents' life and what I was going through growing up. And I couldn't write it now because I'm older. I don't have the kind of you become more private, I think, as you get older. And I wrote that book when I was about 31, and I was really anxious to get out with these feelings, and that's what that book is about.
Well, when they announced the Pulitzers last year and your name came up, tell me what kind of reaction you felt.
Well, it's kind of funny. I was in a state of shock, more or less. The first thing you feel is happiness.
How did you find out, by the way?
I was up in the country trying to cool out at a friend's house, because I had just been in England where the book had come out. And the British are crazy because they have all these crazy promotions, and they really work you hard over there. And so I came back and I said, if I never talk about the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love again, they'll be fine with me. Back to work. So I'm up there for 4 days, and I'd gone antiquing with a friend of mine, and we came back, and my agent was on the phone, and she said, "Oh, don't leave this place. Someone may call you." And I thought it had to do with a sale or something. I didn't know. And it was my publisher, Roger Strauss, and he said, "My boy, you've won the big one," or something like that. And I said, "Really? You're kidding me? I didn't even know. I mean, I didn't even know that it was being announced. I mean, I don't really follow that kind of thing." And I was in a state of shock, but I didn't even have much time for the elation, because then a lot of journalists called me, and I was on the phone for about 3 or 4 hours. And then you know, you talk to your family, and then you just sort of, I don't know, I think that night I watched the tape of a Kirk Douglas movie in which he's a journalist who Ace in the Hole, great film by Billy Wilder, in which he's dumped from his big city job and then ends up working in a small town, and he's absolutely obsessed with getting a scoop that will get him a Pulitzer Prize so he can get his job back in the big city. But it was wonderful. And since that time, I've gotten a lot of support from writers, you know, Latino writers in this country. And it's a nice thing to feel that if indeed the door is opening for new news kind of writing, which is mostly about cultures. I mean, we have Amy Tana I was talking about before with a friend. And, you know, her book, for example, became a big, big bestseller, and it must have. And her parents are immigrants. Mm-hmm. And I remember meeting her mother, and she was very, I wouldn't say she was shell-shocked, but it's the same kind of thing that she's pleased and surprised, and how do you read that kind of success? And my mother now walks around with a giant sun hat and an ascot and walks around with the Pulitzer Prize announcement laminated. So that she can pull it. I mean, it makes people happy, and doesn't hurt anyone, certainly, and it gives you a bigger readership, I think, because the book, which is published by Harper and Row, has this little gold seal of good housekeeping, seal of approval on the cover, and I think that gives you a few more sales than you might have otherwise.
It's going to focus attention, and it's probably going to make you feel uncomfortable when your new book comes out a little bit.
Oh, you mean how do you follow this?
Yeah, how do you follow it? And it may be better, it may be worse. Who knows? It's just that you have to kind of live up to this reputation.
Well, I don't know. I guess it must be, I don't have children, but it must be like having children. I mean, maybe one of your kids is really handsome and or she's beautiful, and maybe you have a kid who's dumb but athletic or really, you know, all your children can't be equally beautiful, but, or interesting or complex, but hopefully if the next novel isn't as original or isn't as emotional in a certain way as the Mambo Kings, I guess I will be accepting of it and find ways to love it that might be different.
Well, I think that you're on kind of a deadline. I think I'm going to have to let you go. You're heading downtown, I believe, for another interview.
Yeah.